From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
General Colin Powell has died at the age of 84. We'll look at his life and legacy, including his role in paving the way for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, to helping shape U.S. military policy in Panama, El Salvador, and Nicaragua during the 1980s. Then, a Democracy Now! Exclusive. We speak with Jean Montreville, a prominent Haitian-American immigrant rights activist who was deported to Haiti in 2018. In a remarkable development, he was allowed to fly back to New York Monday after receiving a 90-day special parole.
This has been my whole fighting to be with my kids. And I've always wanted to be with my kids. And now I get a second chance to be with them again.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former President Donald Trump's filed a lawsuit to stop the Congressional Committee investigating the Capitol insurrection from receiving records about the January 6th riot, as well as Trump's efforts to overturn the will of voters in the November election. Trump's legal team claims the request undermines Trump's executive privilege and is asking for more time to review records requests. This comes as the January 6th committee has laid out its contempt case against former Trump White House strategist Stephen Bannon, who defied a congressional subpoena claiming executive privilege. The committee is expected to vote today to refer Bannon for criminal charges. Meanwhile, Donald Trump gave several hours of videotaped testimony Monday in a deposition ordered by a New York judge. The civil case was brought by six plaintiffs of Mexican descent who say Trump's security guards assaulted them outside Trump Tower in 2015 as they peacefully protested Trump's racist comments about Mexicans. Their lawyer said Monday Trump personally authorized the violence.
We believe there is ample evidence to demonstrate that before and after the incident at issue, the Trump Organization, the Trump campaign, and Donald J. Trump himself authorized and condoned violent acts in violation of individual rights.
A Food and Drug Administration panel has recommended third booster shots of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine for people 65 and older and people at high risk of severe disease or workplace exposure. The FDA is also expected this week to allow U.S. residents to mix and match different COVID-19 vaccines. Colin Powell's family says the former top U.S. general and secretary of state had a form of blood cancer that left him vulnerable to infection before his death from COVID-19 complications Monday at the age of 84. Although Powell was fully vaccinated against COVID-19, he was struggling with both Parkinson's disease and multiple myeloma, which left him severely immunocompromised. On Monday, President Biden ordered flags at the White House to be flown at half staff in Powell's honor through Friday. And top administration officials were effusive in their praise of Powell. This is Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, Vice President Kamala Harris, but first Secretary of State Tony Blinken.
Today, a grateful nation observes the end of a distinguished career and celebrates 35 years of service and victory.
The world lost one of the greatest leaders that we have ever witnessed.
You know, what an incredible American.
As chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Powell was the architect of the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989 and oversaw the U.S.-led war on Iraq in 1991. As Secretary of State under George W. Bush, Powell gave false testimony to the U.N. Security Council in 2003 about non-existent weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, paving the way for the U.S. invasion and occupation. By many estimates, the war killed over a million Iraqis. After headlines, we'll have more on Colin Powell's life and legacy. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin's continuing to derail much of President Biden's legislative agenda, with outrage growing over his demand for income limits and work requirements on families receiving a child tax credit. Manchin said Sunday he wants to offer the $300 a month child tax credit only to families with incomes under $60,000, with children's parents or guardians required to hold a job. An expanded child tax credit favored by nearly all other Democrats would lift an estimated 4.3 million U.S. children out of poverty. Senator Manchin's also refusing to support President Biden's climate change legislation, putting Democrats' infrastructure bill and social spending package at risk. Manchin met separately Monday with two progressive leaders on Capitol Hill, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, and before that, Congressmember Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. The U.S. Justice Department has asked the Supreme Court to halt Texas's near-total ban on abortions after an appeals court overturned a stay on its enforcement last week. The conservative-led Supreme Court previously refused to halt the law before it first went into effect in September. A pair of Supreme Court rulings Monday will help police officers accused of excessive force escape liability in civil lawsuits. The court's unsigned decisions bolster the doctrine of qualified immunity, which shields police officers from lawsuits. In Wisconsin, a new lawsuit accuses the Kenosha Police Department of deputizing armed white nationalist vigilantes during protests over the police shooting of Jacob Blake last year. Video from August 25, 2020, shows Kenosha officers giving out water and praise to vigilantes carrying high-powered semi-automatic rifles. The lawsuit was brought by Gage Grosskreutz, a protester shot in the arm by 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, who also fatally shot two people with an illegally obtained assault rifle. Rittenhouse faces homicide charges in a trial set to begin November 1st. The Venezuelan government's denouncing the capture of Colombian businessman and Venezuelan diplomat Alex Saab, a close ally of President Nicolas Maduro, who was taken from the island nation of Cape Verde and flown to Miami over the weekend. Supporters say Saab was apprehended without any proper legal basis, as the U.S. has no extradition treaty with Cape Verde, an island some 400 miles off the northwestern coast of Africa. Saab was previously detained in Cape Verde for over a year after his private plane made a fuel stop en route to Iran, reportedly to buy humanitarian supplies. The UN Human Rights Committee had called for Saab's extradition order to be suspended and said he'd been denied treatment for his cancer while jailed in Cape Verde. Saab appeared in a Miami court for the first time Monday facing corruption charges. In response, Venezuela's government has halted negotiations with its opponents. This is Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro.
A plane arrived. Assassins, hitmen came down. They sought him out and they removed him with blows. From the jail he was held, they took him without advising lawyers, nor the family, nor anybody. A kidnapping by the United States government of an international diplomat.
NBC News reports the Homeland Security Department's planning to build an intelligence gathering cell to closely surveil the movement of groups of migrants in Central and South America who may be making their way to the United States to seek asylum. DHS officials are also seeking to establish aerial surveillance of trucks and migrant camps across multiple borders and increase collaboration between Central and South American authorities and U.S. agents. The cell will reportedly be operational by the end of October. This comes as some 90,000 migrants hoping to reach the U.S. for refuge remain trapped in the southern Mexican city of Tapachula. This is Luis Garcia, a human rights advocate.
The Biden administration will give $20 million to the Mexican and Central American governments to contain migrants and to find out what is going on. They should give $10 million to this city and then all of us could stay here. But they should do it under the scrutiny of the whole world. Otherwise, the money just goes into containment and deportation that the Mexican government is carrying out.
In Miami, at least 10 immigrant justice advocates were arrested Monday after temporarily blocking the entrance to Port Miami by laying in the roadway. The act of civil disobedience was led by several groups calling the Biden administration to end the deportation of Haitian asylum seekers and issue permanent and humane immigration relief for millions of people. Haiti's justice minister says the criminal gang that kidnapped 17 U.S. and Canadian missionaries and their children is asking for $1 million for each hostage's release, amounting to $17 million. The Biden administration said Monday the FBI was in negotiations with the kidnappers from the gang 400 Mawozo. Here in New York, Jean Montreville, a father of four and longtime immigrant rights leader, has returned home to the United States on a special 90-day parole after he was deported to Haiti in 2018. Democracy Now! Has followed Jean Montreville's case for over a decade. Later in the broadcast, he'll join us from a studio here in New York for an exclusive interview. Indigenous communities from Ecuador's Amazon rainforest have filed a lawsuit against the government of right-wing President Guillermo Lasso to halt his plans for a massive expansion of oil and mining extraction in the region, endangering millions of acres of pristine and sacred land and the livelihood of indigenous nations. Hundreds of indigenous elders and youth arrived to the capital, Quito, Monday to file the Ecuadorian lawsuit with Ecuador's highest court. This is Waorani leader speaking yesterday.
As Waorani de Pastaza, our territory is life. We live there, cultivate, fish, hunt. We grow yuca and plantains to feed our children. We rely on the rainforest, on the land, on the river. If oil companies enter the Waorani of Pastaza territory, all the 22 communities that live there and others will be affected.
In Italy, tens of thousands of anti-fascist protesters rallied in Rome Saturday in a show of strength, 1 week after right-wing extremists smashed the offices of Italy's oldest trade union organization. Among those marching was Maurizio Landini, Secretary General of the Italian General Confederation of Labor.
Fascist movements that use violence must be dissolved. We ask for concrete acts, not just chatter. From solidarity, we must move on to concrete action. And it is time for the state to demonstrate its democratic strength in enforcing laws and applying the principles of the Constitution.
And here in New York City, a group of taxi drivers is launching a hunger strike starting tomorrow as they continue to demand New York enact debt relief for thousands of drivers who've been devastated by massive debt accrued largely due to the artificially inflated cost of taxi medallions. This comes after taxi drivers held a 30-day round-the-clock protest outside City Hall. Drivers have also been denouncing the mental health impacts triggered by the financial ruin. At least 9 taxi drivers have died by suicide. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we look at the life and legacy of General Colin Powell, from his role in paving the way for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 to helping shape U.S. military policy in Panama, El Salvador, and Nicaragua during the 1980s. Stay with us. Nancy by Philip Glass, performed by Yo-Yo Ma and the Philip Glass Ensemble. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Biden ordered flags at the White House to be flown at half staff in honor of General Colin Powell, who died Monday at the age of 84. Powell was the first black Secretary of State, the first black and youngest chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the first black national security advisor. On Monday, tributes poured in from both Republican and Democratic leaders. President Biden called Powell a, quote, patriot of unmatched honor and dignity. But in other parts of the world, Powell is remembered very differently. In Iraq, the journalist Muntadhar al-Zaidi, who famously threw a shoe at President George W. Bush, tweeted that he was sad Powell had died before being tried for his crimes in Iraq. While serving as Secretary of State under Bush, General Powell played a pivotal role in paving the way for the U.S. invasion. It was February 5, 2003, that Powell addressed the United Nations Security Council and made the case for a first strike on Iraq. Powell's message was clear. Iraq possessed extremely dangerous weapons of mass destruction, and Saddam Hussein was systematically trying to deceive UN inspectors by hiding the prohibited weapons.
One of the most worrisome things that emerges from the thick intelligence file we have on Iraq's biological weapons is the existence of mobile production facilities used to make biological agents. Let me take you inside that intelligence file and share with you what we know from eyewitness accounts. We have first-hand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels and on rails. The trucks and train cars are easily moved and are designed to evade detection by inspectors. In a matter of months, they can produce a quantity of biological poison equal to the entire amount that Iraq claimed to have produced in the years prior to the Gulf War.
All of Colin Powell's main claims about weapons of mass destruction turned out to be false. He later described the speech as a blot on his record. But the 2003 speech was not the first time General Powell had falsely alleged Iraq had WMDs. In 1991, during the Persian Gulf War, the U.S. bombed Iraq's only baby formula factory. At the time, General Powell said, quote, it is not an infant formula factory. It was a biological weapons facility. Of that, we are sure, he said. Well, UN investigators later confirmed the bomb factory was, in fact, making baby formula. While many in Iraq consider Powell to be a war criminal, just like they consider George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, Powell has long been celebrated at home. Colin Powell was born in Harlem in 1937. His parents had both immigrated from Jamaica. He was educated in public schools, including City College of New York, before he joined the military through ROTC. He served two tours in Vietnam. He was later accused of helping to whitewash the My Lai massacre, when U.S. soldiers slaughtered up to 500 villagers, most of them women, children, and the elderly. While investigating an account of the massacre filed by a soldier, Powell wrote, quote, in direct refutation of this portrayal is the fact that relations between American soldiers and the Vietnamese people are excellent, he said. Powell spent 35 years in the military, rising to chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In the 1980s, he helped shape U.S. military policy in Latin America at a time when U.S.-backed forces killed hundreds of thousands of people in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and other countries. Powell also helped oversee the U.S. invasion of Panama and the Persian Gulf War. From 2001 to 2005, he served as Secretary of State under George W. Bush. After working under three Republican presidents, General Powell made headlines in 2008 when he endorsed Barack Obama for president just 2 weeks before Election Day. Earlier this year, General Powell said he no longer considered himself a Republican following the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. General Colin Powell died on Monday. His family said he died from COVID-19 complications. He was struggling with both Parkinson's disease and multiple myeloma, which left him severely immunocompromised. To talk more about Powell's life and legacy, we're joined by two guests. Roberta Lovato is with us, award-winning journalist, author of Unforgetting, a memoir of family migration, gangs, and revolution in the Americas. He's closely tracked General Powell's history in Latin America. We're also joined by Clarence Lussain, professor at Howard University. He's author of many books, including Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, Foreign Policy, Race, and the New American Century. Professor Lussain, let's begin with you. If you can talk about the legacy of Colin Powell.
Thank you, Amy, and thank your other guests. So Powell leaves a very—he was a complicated political figure who leaves a complicated legacy. As you outlined in your introduction, Powell has a rise-from-the-bottom story that really captured the imagination of many people. He rose from growing up in poor areas, or at least low-income areas in New York, to become fourth in line to president when he became the Secretary of State. In the early 1990s, he was championed by both Democrats and Republicans and recruited by both to run for president. He declined in 1995, and when he declined, he announced that he was joining the Republican Party. Now, the Republican Party he joined in 1995 was the Republican Party of Newt Gingrich, and it did not seem to be a fit. Colin was pro-choice, pro-affirmative action, pro-immigration, call for gun control, all of which the Republican Party under Newt Gingrich and going forward have been against. As you point out, he joins the George W. Bush administration, the very first choice, in fact, of George W. Bush for his cabinet, because Powell has the international gravitas and respect that nobody else in and around George W. Bush has. But he never really fit in. And in the first 8 or 9 months of the George W. Bush administration, Powell lost fight after fight after fight when Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and others who were what we call the neoconservatives, the neocons, were really running the administration. And there was a pretty good bet that Powell was not going to last until the end of the year. But then September 11 happens. Powell, always the loyal soldier, decides to stay, but he's still very isolated. He says that they basically saw him as a milk carton. They put him in the refrigerator, and when they needed him, they would bring him off the shelf, and then they would put him back. They brought him off the shelf in 2003 to talk at the UN because there was no one else in the administration who could get the attention and at least some belated respect. And Colin Powell went and gave that talk, which was from A to Z false. But he was the only one in the administration. And then, of course, a year and a half later, he's gone. But he's complicated because in many ways he did not fit in with the Republican Party, even though he did not leave until early this year. But he increasingly, and anyone who was moderate, and particularly black moderates, simply had no place in the Republican Party. And so he endorses Obama. He endorses Biden. He endorses Hillary Clinton, or at least he votes for them. So he really had moved and been moved out of the Republican Party for many years. But he really wasn't a Democrat or seen as a progressive either, again, because of a long history of aggression internationally, going all the way back to Reagan and the Contras and all of the foreign policy controversies of the 1980s. And then under the Bush administration, which not only included Iraq, but also included the Bush policies towards Cuba, towards Venezuela, their policies around Africa, all of which increasingly isolated Colin Powell from the progressive communities.
Well, Professor, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the need for both the Democrats and the Republicans to repeatedly lionize and hold up General Powell, especially, but then a Secretary of State Powell as a key and important American figure, given the fact that the U.S. military, of all the institutions in American society, none is more racially diverse, it seems to me, than the U.S. military, with about 40% or more than 40% of the troops as people of color. So could you talk about the importance of Powell as a figure, given the demographics and the changes in the American military?
Thanks, Juan. So part of the capital that Colin Powell builds is precisely because he rises up to the top of an institution, one of the few that had not seemed to be tainted by political partisanship. And he rises up and becomes head of Joint Chiefs of Staff. And Powell's personality is not a belligerent one, one that we have unfortunately come to see more and more in military figures and political figures. And Powell's activism relative to addressing issues of race. So when we think of the conservative African-Americans who are in and around the Republican Party, the Clarence Thomases, the Candace Owens, those types tend to come to mind. But there were African-American conservatives who took positions that were supportive of issues related to the Black community and were active and supportive of civil rights. So Powell fits into that. And so that gave him some cachet. He spoke at my graduation at Howard University in 1994 and talked about issues of racism, issues of being socially engaged. You're not going to find that coming from virtually any of the people we think of as Black Republicans these days. So that gave Colin Powell a different kind of public-facing image, which was in conflict, again, with many of the policies in the party that he supported and in the administration in which he was involved.
Well, I'd like to also bring in Roberto Lovato into the discussion. And Roberto, I'm wondering if you could talk especially about people forget that back in the invasion of Panama, not only was Colin Powell a key figure, but that the Secretary of Defense at the time was Dick Cheney.
Yeah, thank you, Juan and Amy. I'm glad to be back with you. The story of Colin Powell in Central America and other parts of the world is what I would call a tragic tale of militarism in the service of declining empire. And it also previews what I call the age of intersectional empire that Clarence laid out a little bit of about in terms of how race is being deployed by the militaristic bipartisan consensus elites in the United States. And so Panama comes about, remember, right after the Central America engagements in El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and that was preceded by the Vietnam War, when you have a decline in the morale and the sensibilities of the U.S. military, having suffered a defeat, a severe defeat in Vietnam. And so Powell was part of a cadre of leaders trying to figure out how to create a post-Vietnam animus for the U.S. military machine. But one thing I want to make clear is that the Powell doctrine of overwhelming force, bringing in the public into supporting U.S. war, clearly defined national security objectives and other things that define what they call the Powell-Weinberger doctrine are still war policies. And so Colin Powell's political career was one thing in terms of race and being pro-abortion, but in terms of militarism, it was clear. In El Chorrillo neighborhood, which taxi drivers in Panama still call the Little Hiroshima, you know, hundreds of people were killed. They're still excavating mass grave sites of the invasion of Panama. And so, you know, and prior to that, remember, Powell was an assistant to then Secretary of Defense under the Reagan administration, Caspar Weinberger, who was, you know, charged with overseeing military policy in Central America, which instead of going into what they called, you know, asymmetrical warfare in like they did in Vietnam and got beat up, the militarists like Colin Powell decided to stray away from those kinds of war and fight them through proxies and instead focus on building up to get big, you know, state-to-state military wars. And so the fight against Manuel Noriega, also on false pretenses, was a preview and a preparation for the state-to-state war that followed in Kuwait and Iraq.
And in that U.S. invasion of Panama that he spearheaded, can you talk about who died, Clarence Lussein, in Panama? Yeah. We're not just talking about abstract intellectual, you know, policy issues.
So that's exactly right, as Ron laid out. I actually went to Panama. I went with another reporter, Stan Woods, from out of Chicago. We went down after the invasion, and it was horrific. As was mentioned, there were mass graves. There were total destruction of neighborhoods. They bombed, and these were poor neighborhoods, we should be clear. So there were wealthy neighborhoods that were surgically missed while they bombed neighborhoods that had not only been active, but had been, you know, very much embodied people who lived there. So it was a horrific invasion. And Powell said nothing about it. It was similar to other military endeavors by the Bush administration and the Reagan administration. Powell was silent on the consequences that thousands and thousands and thousands of people and hundreds of thousands of people died in Iraq, but certainly thousands of people died in Panama. And there still has not been an accounting for that particularly horrible invasion.
And these were heavily black population.
And these were Afro-Panamanians. That's exactly right.
So Roberto Lovato, go a little before the invasion of Panama to explain the Iran-Contra deal and the role of General Powell at the time. The invasion of Panama was under George H.W. Bush, and the Iran-Contra deal, of course, was when he was vice president, when it was President Ronald Reagan, the ultimately illegal deal to sell weapons to Iran, take that money and illegally support the Contras, which was against, at the time, the Boland Amendment that said the U.S. could not support the counter-revolutionaries in Nicaragua.
So Powell, we have to remember, was what he himself called the, quote, chief administration advocate for the Contras, the U.S.-sponsored insurgency and try to overthrow the Nicaraguan Sandinista government. I mean, Human Rights Watch and other organizations around the world have documented tens of thousands of people killed, nuns raped, children destroyed by the Contras. And Colin Powell would go on to say that I have no regrets about my role and that he fought very hard to get support for the Contras. So Powell, as Assistant Secretary to Caspar Weinberger, was privy to information about the arms for hostages and, you know, giving money to the Contras deal, but managed to evade judgment, unlike Weinberger, who was indicted and condemned, and then I believe pardoned, thanks to lobbying by Colin Powell. And so Powell's proven skillful, not just in terms of kind of helping re-engineer the post-Vietnam military, but he's also been skillful at evading political judgment, as we saw with My Lai, as we see in Iran-Contra, and, you know, having this idea that the one, quote-unquote, blotch on his record is the lies around Iraq is a travesty, because he's made a career out of, you know, being a good soldier and supporting U.S. mass murder around the world, but evading the credit for it. So I'll leave it there.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could talk, Roberto, a little bit about, for instance,
his legacy in terms of arming and training the Salvadoran army, and including his relation with Jose Napoleon Duarte, who was the president of El Salvador in the 1980s.
Yeah. Powell was one of the Reagan administration's point people in Central America, and as the point person, helped to tee up, you know, and then legitimate when necessary, the Salvadoran military dictatorships and the Guatemalan and other militaries in the region that are responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocents. And so in the case of Guatemala, like 200 or more thousand, mostly Mayan indigenous people. And so like in 1983, for example, Powell was part of a fact-finding kind of mission that included Jean Kirkpatrick and Weinberger to go and see if the Salvadoran, to go confirm the Salvadoran military and government were doing the right thing under, you know, Duarte. And, you know, they found that, you know, they were doing the right thing and that the U.S. should continue, you know, heavily funding and training these murderous militaries. He never said anything about the fact that just a year before and a couple of years before, the massacre of El Sumpul, where about 600 people were killed, was perpetrated by the U.S.-backed Salvadoran government. The massacre of El Mozote, where 1,000 people were killed, an entire town wiped out, half of the victims under age 12, and half of those children under age 12 were under age 6. Powell seemed to have amnesia about that, along with Elliot Abrams, another, I would say, war criminal, and El Coloboso, and other massacres were completely ignored. And so we see Powell playing a role in Central America over the years, from the early 80s all the way to the end of the war. And, you know, Powell was very sophisticated and smart in terms of moving with the times, so that when it called for a hard line at the beginning of the Reagan era, he was there. When it called for, remember, in 1989, the FMLN guerrillas, for example, we launched an offensive in the capital of San Salvador to basically demonstrate to the U.S. government and the Salvadoran government that it was supporting, that they couldn't defeat the FMLN guerrillas. And so that worked. It was basically the offensive showed that the guerrillas were able to enter into the capital and fight on their own terms. So Powell and the Bush administration, you know, seeing this, pivoted and pushed the Salvadoran government to peace. Now, some historians will call Powell a peacenik, almost a liberal, which, I mean, if you're comparing him to like Alexander Haig or just uber fascist like that, then yeah. But in the larger scheme of empire and militarism, Colin Powell has been, you know, was always a loyal cadre to mass murdering empire.
So let's go back to Colin Powell's 2003 speech at the UN, where he falsely accused Iraq of possessing weapons of mass destruction.
Every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
All of General Powell's main claims about weapons of mass destruction turned out to be false. But at the time, most of the media took Powell at his word. The invasion of Iraq began 6 weeks after he made his speech at the United Nations. He himself recognized it was the final nail in the coffin for so many, because he had called himself a reluctant warrior. He had dragged his feet on the war, and President Bush wanted his support to be the voice and face of this war. In 2013, Democracy Now! Spoke to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who served as Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. Wilkerson helped prepare Powell's infamous UN speech, which he later renounced. Wilkerson said Powell himself was suspicious of the intelligence and wanted to delete any reference in the speech to ties between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein.
The seminal moment, as we were out at Langley and Colin Powell was getting ready to throw everything out of his presentation that had anything to do with terrorism, that is, substantial contacts between Baghdad and al-Qaeda in particular, as he was getting, he was really angry. He took me in a room by myself and literally attacked me over it. And I said, "Boss, let's throw it out. I have as many doubts about it as you do. Let's throw it out. And so we made a decision right there to throw it out. Within 30 minutes of the secretary having made that decision and instructed me to do so, George Tenet showed up with a bombshell. And the bombshell was that a high-level al-Qaeda operative under interrogation had revealed substantial contacts between al-Qaeda and Baghdad.
So that is the chief of staff of a former Secretary of State, Colin Powell. He is an Army colonel, Lawrence Wilkerson. In 2009, Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy questioned Colin Powell about the false claims he made during the UN speech that was based in part on false information provided by prisoners who'd been tortured.
General, can you talk about the al-Libi case and the link between torture and the production of tortured evidence for war?
I don't have any details on the al-Libi case.
Can you tell us when you learned that some of the evidence that you used in front of the UN was based on torture? When did you learn that?
I don't know that. I don't know what information you're referring to, so I can't answer.
Your chief of staff, Wilkerson, has written about this.
So what?
So you think you know about it?
General, there's a debate in America about
the information I presented to the UN was vetted by the CIA. Every word came from the CIA, and they stood behind all that information. I don't know that any of them believe that torture was involved. I don't know that as a fact. A lot of speculation, particularly by people who never attended any of these meetings, but I'm not aware of that.
Clarence Lussain, we're going to give you the final word. Again, this speech he would later call a blot on his career.
So the thing to remember about this that period is that the entire global community was against the invasion. So when Colin Powell and the Bush administration says that they were vetting this information, they were not listening not only to their allies, they were not listening to what the United Nations itself was actually doing and had essentially proven that there were no weapons of mass destruction. But the administration was determined to go, and Colin Powell basically acceded to that, as he would do both prior to that speech, as he did with the World Conference Against Racism, when the United States and Israel were the only two countries that pulled out. And as he would do after the invasion of Iraq on other policies by the George W. Bush administration, until he was finally driven out. So there does have to be an accounting for that record. And there's no way to kind of pretty it up. It was atrocious. And again, hundreds of thousands and some estimates up to a million people died as a result of that war.
And there are still thousands of U.S. troops in Iraq. Clarence Lussain, I want to thank you for being with us, professor at Howard University, author of Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, Foreign Policy, Race, and the New American Century. And Roberto Lovato, Salvadoran-American journalist and author, wrote his memoir, Unforgetting, a memoir of family migration, gangs, and revolution in the Americas. In 30 seconds, we bring you a Democracy Now! Exclusive, a conversation with Jean Montreville, a prominent Haitian-American immigrant rights activist who was deported to Haiti several years ago. Now, in a remarkable development, he was allowed to fly back to New York. Stay with us.
You'd have never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the
Masters of War by Bob Dylan. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to an incredible story Democracy Now! Has followed for more than a decade. As reported in headlines, activists blocked the port of Miami Monday to protest deportations to Haiti, where people face extreme economic and political instability. Around the same time Monday, here in New York, Jean Montreville, a prominent Haitian-American immigrant rights activist, father of four U.S.-born children, returned home to New York. This after he was deported to Haiti in 2018. In a remarkable development, he was allowed to fly back after receiving a 90-day special parole. Like many black immigrants, Jean faced the double punishment of deportation after he served a harsh sentence decades ago at the height of the war on drugs. When he was released from prison in 2000, he reported for years to check-ins with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and also helped found the New Sanctuary Coalition to engage churches and immigrant defense with another group called Families for Freedom. Jean Montreville was first on Democracy Now! In 2010 after ICE detained, then released him following the devastating earthquake in Haiti that year. We last spoke to Jean in Port-au-Prince after he was deported in 2018. Well, on Monday, Jean Montreville's children and supporters greeted him at the airport as he returned home, and his defense committee shared this video with us.
Here, hold that.
Baggage claim, waiting for my father to get off his flight. He recently got his 90-day pardon, and so he'll be coming back from Haiti.
I'm Josiah Montreville, and as my last name implies, I'm his son. Feeling a lot of different things, mainly excited, still in shock that it's happening. Like, I don't think I'll be able to fully process it until I actually see and hug him.
For once, I'm going to take him out shopping this week.
Do you know if the plane arrived?
Yes, the plane has landed. I could check. They should be boarding now and going to ICE.
What do you think is happening back there?
I honestly don't know. I feel like since I know he didn't have a passport and they just gave him, like, papers, so they might, like, have to do, like, an extra scan through. But I don't know. A part of me want to, like, run back there and see what's going on.
I'm Jane Trujillo, and I've been accompanying Jean on this journey since 2007. We, you know, did check-ins, but we've also become good friends, and he's been in my house and with his kids, and he's a very special person.
My name is Ted Dawson. I'm a member of Dutton Memorial Church, and I'm here to celebrate Jean coming home. I'm part of a team here that began accompanying Jean to his check-ins 10, 12, 15 years ago. We became very close to him during that process, and we became much, much more involved as the process went along, and we could see the injustices that were happening across the board in the immigration system, and ICE in particular, and we just grew to love Gene and his family. And when this happened to him, it was part of us. They deported us also, because Gene was deported because of his activism.
I'm Ravi Raghbir, and Gene and I go way back. They have been trying to deport us for many years. In fact, I was in Chrome Detention Center with him when he was deported. He had been working as collaborators to stop our own detention, but other people's detention. So it has been a long struggle, and I'm excited that Gene is here and that he will continue to support the end of deportation for people. And this will be, it will be able to give people the strength and the knowledge that they can, if they fight, they can win. So it will allow hope for many people who have been in the same struggle with, like Gene and myself.
Excited to be with my family. That's been my whole dream. And the trip was okay. I've been up since 4 this morning. I haven't ate nothing. Yeah, happy to be with my family. This has been my whole fighting to be with my kids. And I've always wanted to be with my kids. And now I get a second chance to be with them again. Exciting. Very happy.
Oh,
Jean Montreville being greeted at the airport with people holding signs, "Welcome home, Jean," with his face on some of those signs. Special thanks to Laura Bustillos for filming that joyous reunion of Jean with his family and supporters after returning home yesterday. He was deported in 2018, then granted a 90-day special parole, which is why he's back, hoping to stay for much longer. In this Democracy Now! Exclusive, Jean, how does it feel in this first interview back? How does it feel to be home?
It feels great, Amy. And thank you for having me again today. I mean, I'm very excited, man, just to be here with my kids again. As you know, this has always been about my kids. And now I finally got a second chance. And to see my kids again, I cannot tell you how excited that I am. Very excited, man. I'm so happy.
And I should say that we're also joined by Alina Das, Jean Montreville's lawyer and co-director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at NYU School of Law. You had not been home to Haiti in, what, some 30 years. Talk about your plans now. As so many Haitians are being deported back to Haiti, you have been able to come home.
Yes, and it's heartbreaking, man. It hurt my heart a lot just to see people getting deported back to a country where there's no government, a country that's being run by gangs members. And the U.S. say no, that they know Haiti don't have a functioning government. Everybody is afraid to go outside. Things are getting so expensive. People cannot eat. People cannot do nothing in Haiti. It's really very heartbroken. It broke my heart just to see that Biden government cannot take deporting people just like they need to take a second look at the policies. To watch people walk 2 months on foot, walking, crossing the Darien forest just to be here, knock on your door, and then you still deport them back with their kids. And it's very heartbroken. I think the Biden administration need to take a second look and to stop the deportation to Haiti. You cannot deport people to where there's no government. There is no government in Haiti. The country is being run by gangs, remember. Gangs are everywhere. Just like you mentioned earlier, the 400 Mausos, the Matissan group, it's terrible. And the government know that.
I wanted to ask Alina Das to talk about the campaign to bring Jean back, especially the role of the pardon that Governor Northam gave to him, how that helped. And also, if you could talk about the Biden administration's change of policy, for instance, Alex Mayorkas, the Homeland Security chief, basically directing the activists who are exercising their First Amendment rights should not be targeted for deportation. How extensive has that been in the past?
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for having us. And I think all of these victories are really a signal of how important the work Jean has been doing for so long is. I mean, Jean has been organizing in the immigrant rights movement since 2005. He saw what was happening to him and his family, and he realized that this was happening to families everywhere. And he inspired a movement. And so when his voice made him a target for deportation in 2018, and he was deported to Haiti, that movement lived on. He taught us to keep fighting. And so with his church, with Families for Freedom, with the New Sanctuary Movement, with so many others, we didn't give up. And we've fought until he's here. I can't believe he's here sitting right next to me in New York. And I think that that is a victory for family unity. It's everything that Jean has envisioned for an immigration system, one that welcomes, one that protects immigrant voices. And we are so grateful to see a change in that policy, to see Secretary Mayorkas say that immigrants will not be targeted for engaging in First Amendment activity, for speaking out about the injustices they see. And what we want to see now is that principle be put into action. You know, Gene's here with us. He's been given the special parole. But the fight isn't over. We have to make sure that Gene is with us to stay and that other immigrant activists can be rest assured that they can be here and remain with their families to continue to speak out and to speak up and protect our rights without fear of deportation.
And Alina, explain the role of the Virginia governor, Governor Northam.
Yes. Governor Northam gave us a tremendous gift. He recognized, and this is the power of clemency, that people deserve second chances. Gene received a deportation order nearly 30 years ago because of a very old conviction that he received at the height of the war on drugs. After he served his time and lived his life, raised his family, four children, an incredible community, it was only then that he faced a second punishment of deportation. And we believe in second chances, and the pardon, which is something that the governor of Virginia granted to Gene, recognizes that. It gives him an opportunity to try and reopen his case, to get his lawful permanent residency back, and to be able to live here in this country that is his home with his family.
And Gene, you're also pursuing a federal lawsuit against immigration officials for targeting you because, again, there's some report that as many as 1,000 immigrant rights activists have been deported in the past, basically because of their speaking out.
Yes, this was during the Trump administration. Trump targeted immigrant rights activists like myself who were speaking out against ICE, which is a terrible, terrible, terrible institution, man. They didn't care about family unity. They didn't care about what you was standing for. And because of that, I mean, the lawsuit Alina filed, and thank to her, I want to say, a big thank you to Alina, and she probably saved my life. And I will refer to her on the lawsuit. I really don't know much.
Yeah, so, no, I
Alina,
think the,
could you talk about
the
it?
Lawsuit itself is an incredible testament to the voice that Gene gave to the movement. He spoke out, and we don't believe that anyone should be targeted for deportation, to be jailed, to be taken away from their family, to be expelled from this country because they've chosen to speak out and to educate all of us about what's really happening in the immigration system. So that lawsuit continues to be pending, and we are just so grateful that people are listening. They're listening to Gene. They're willing to stand up for those who've been targeted for their activism.
Gene, the old slogan for your campaign was Bring Gene Home. Monday, as people stood at the airport, they held signs that said Welcome Home, Gene. Today, it's Keep Gene Home. What is next? And talk about your message for both the DHS Secretary Mayorkas and for President Biden. And for immigrants and activists around this country?
Well, for immigrants, I want to tell them, don't give up. Don't give up. Don't be afraid to fight. Fight for your case. Fight for what's right. We deserve to be here. America has always been a country of immigrants. And nothing has changed in the immigrants' world. People travel to here just to find a better way to live, to support their families back home. There's nothing changed in the immigration world. You can talk about 100 years from 200 years ago. It has always been the same. You move somewhere to flee. You flee your country for persecution, for poverty, to find a better way to take care of your family. Imagine all these Haitians who walks 11 countries, Amy, just to get to the Texas border, and then you put them back on a plane to say, no, you cannot welcome here. It's racism. It's racism. That's all it is. Haiti has always been suffered for racism in this country. And we know that. I think it's time for the Biden administration to take a second look. You cannot have these people suffering just to knock on your door, and then you take them back to a country where you know there's no government. And it's really heartbreaking. It breaks my heart. And I hope the Biden administration really think twice. And they need to take a second chance. And I will continue to speak out. I'm not going to give up.
Gene,
I will be there.
We have to leave probably. It there. But again, welcome home, Gene. That's Gene Montreville, Haitian immigrant and activist, just back in New York Monday. And Alina Das, Gene's lawyer and co-director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at NYU School of Law. Special thanks to Renee Feltz. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.